We're hearing a case for why public lands should be protected and connected in large blocks, large chunks that would span the continent in order to help wildlife adapt to a warming climate. You're with us for this conversation on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. America's public lands unite people from all walks of life, and the federal government owns 640 million acres. That's about 28% of the land in this country. We're taking a closer look at how these public lands are potentially harmed, especially in the midst of climate change. Do you think private lands should be open for public development? What about logging and drilling operations? Do you think federally designated lands should be devoted to conservation or open to development options? The number is 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Stephen Nash is a visiting senior research scholar and an adjunct faculty member in the Journalism Department and Environmental Studies Program at the University of Richmond. His most recent book is called Grand Canyon for Sale, Public Land versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. Stephen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. So, nice to talk with you.
Yeah, so we tend to think of national parks as these islands of conservation, that there's like this barrier around them. But you've argued that in order to protect national parks, we need to worry about places outside of them and specifically other public lands. Why is this?
It's because of climate change, principally. But it's always been the case that as wonderful as our national parks are when you visit them, and although they look pretty substantial on a map, they've never been quite large enough biologically to sustain the wildlife that's so important to us. Grand Canyon, over the years since it was established, and it's been 100 years this month since the national park was created, Grand Canyon has lost 20% of its mammal species. It is just too small a home to keep those populations going. With climate change, all of those islands are, in effect, going to be moving south climatically. So is Wisconsin. But if you look at Grand Canyon as an example, or Yosemite or Yellowstone National Parks, they're going to be moving 400 miles south in terms of their climates between now and the next few decades and then the end of the century. And what that means is all of the plants and animals, species that live within the parks are going to have to, some of them are going to have to be adapting by migrating north. If they have public lands available, they can do that.
Right. So where do public lands enter this equation? How could they be helpful with that forced migration, if you will?
Let's go back to something you said just a moment ago, which is very important and was very hard for me to grasp when I began looking into all of this, that nearly a third of our national landscape is federal public land. That's an enormous amount of land and a huge opportunity. When we say federal public land, we're talking about national forests. And help me with pronunciation, Shequamagon.
Nicolet. You're in the neighborhood.
Okay. All right, that's great. So national forests, wildlife refuges, national monuments, which aren't like the Washington Monument. Actually, some of them are 1 million acres or more. All of those public lands and others that I haven't named, if they are consolidated and if they are protected more or less along the lines of how national parks are protected, that means those plants and animals that are trying to adapt to climate change will have some place to go. As that climate moves south, in effect, getting hotter and hotter, animals will have to migrate north, and public lands will let them do that.
We're talking about what happens to public lands with Stephen Nash as our guide. He is a visiting senior research scholar, adjunct faculty member in the Journalism Department and Environmental Studies Program at University of Richmond. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you think should be done to protect national parks and other public lands in the U.S.? Do you live near federally designated land, like the Ice Age Trail. How do you see it being protected? How do you see it being compromised? 800-642-1234. Tweet us WPR Mornings. Stephen, let's talk about policy. What legal protections do national parks have that other public lands do not?
The important ones for this conversation are that you can't do mining in a national park, and you can't drill for gas and oil, you can't harvest timber, and you can't, except under extraordinary circumstances, graze cattle. We still have cattle grazing in a few national parks for reasons of decoration, I guess, but those are the main stress factors on those other public lands outside national parks that you can't do in a national park. The landscape is the priority there, and the wild species that need that habitat.
Well, let's look at logging for a moment. Loggers in the Shawamagon-Nicolet National Forest harvested about 14,000 acres of the more than 860,000 acres available for timber harvests in the National Forest last year. And this was done through the Good Neighbor Authority, which is this authority that gives the state to basically go through with managing National Forest land. Is the federal government's Good Neighbor Authority protecting National Forests?
If we look at national forests generally, no program is protecting them. Nothing protects them from climate change. What forest management practices dictate as climate change comes on the national forest is that they need to be managed in certain ways. The species are going to change. In the Shawamagon-Nicolet, for instance, sugar maple and balsam firs are going to be under increasing stress, and bur oak and white oak are, as an example, of species that are going to come in instead. Those forests need to be managed not to prioritize timber harvesting, but to prioritize natural systems. It doesn't mean there's no place for timber harvest. It means it has to be very carefully handled.
How does the pace of climate change factor into this? If animals are having a difficult time migrating and adapting, what are the chances that tree species that thrive on our national lands and take longer to develop, you know, will they make it?
That's a question that science has not yet answered. There have been calculations about how fast some tree species can move. And, of course, a tree can't move, but it's some wonderfully interesting science about how the pollen moves, how the seeds move, and whether the wind or the squirrels or some other factor can move them north fast enough to keep up with climate change. But you put your finger on a crucial matter. It may be that they'll need help from us to move as they try to adapt, because sometimes they're not going to move as fast as the climate is moving.
And do we see this happening right now? Do we see evidence of this?
We do in some places, and northern places especially are beginning to see some changes because they're feeling the advancing heat more rapidly. But, you know, it was just announced yesterday by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that 2018 was the fourth hottest year on record, and the three preceding years were even hotter. We're watching forests to the south. As you know, they go up in flames by the millions of acres. There are several reasons for that, not just climate change, but scientists tell us that at least it's a kind of a dim preview of what a lot of our forests are in for.
We're talking about how to protect public lands in the face of climate change with Stephen Nash as our guide. He's a visiting senior research scholar at the University of Richmond. You can join in 800-642-1234. Do you have a connection to a forest? Do you see it being protected? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings, back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're We're talking about protecting public lands on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. One day before the longest government shutdown in history, President Trump issued an executive order that called for increased logging and forest thinning on more than 4 million acres of public lands. And this was an effort to combat extreme wildfires. But some environmental groups are saying this move ignores the role climate change plays in starting wildfires. It's one of the threads we're talking about as we look at how public lands are preserved and protected. Do you think public lands should be open for private development? What do you think should be done to protect national parks? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to the phones now with Dave joining us from Fort Atkinson. Dave, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What are your thoughts here?
Well, a thought occurred to me. The U.S. has been managing public lands for, a couple of hundred or a hundred or more years. And the thought occurred, why not put the control over it back to the First Nations, and specifically the First Nation, tribes that occupied the land before we took it from them. And they would still be public lands just like they are now, but instead of President Trump dictating that logging will happen, the tribes will figure that out and kind of dictate that direction. And I'm curious to see what you guys think of that.
Stephen Nash, what do you think about moving the authority to tribal nations?
I think I've spoken with biologists, actually, who suggest a kindred idea, that there is a lot of knowledge, sort of generational knowledge, in many tribal councils about how the land used to be managed in a much more sustainable way. The current administration has not only decreed that we'll have 30% more logging, oil and gas leases have tripled during the Trump administration. It's no secret that President Trump has said that he's not interested in science, doesn't believe climate change is a problem. The First Nations have been first in line to protest that the Trump administration has cut back 10 national monuments, a couple of them by millions of acres. So, yes, I think it would be great for more authority and more consultation to incorporate tribal wisdom about that. I think it's a cooperative effort everywhere that needs to be in place to manage these public lands, again, with natural systems as the priority. It doesn't mean there's no place for any other activity on those lands, but we have to decide what's most important to us and what's most under threat. We don't need more coal mines.
Is it more from a political standpoint, though, is it advantageous to sell public lands because they don't produce any or as much revenue?
A lot of people think that that it is, who are paid to think that way by the oil and gas industry and the timber industry and the cattle industry. It depends what you mean by advantageous. If you want to advantage private industry in the short term for very short-term economic gain as a sort of a private piggy bank, yeah, that's advantageous. If you want to keep maintaining the kinds of natural systems that we see in national parks, then it is absolutely destructive, and that's what we're seeing now.
So it seems reasonable for public lands to be open to many different uses. How can we strike a happy medium between keeping public lands for conservation purposes but allowing some development at the same time? Where do you strike a balance?
Well, that's been the question for public lands outside national parks for about 100 years now, and it's the right question to ask. Sometimes we pretend we can do everything, but you can't have oil and gas drilling rigs and migrating antelope. You can't do intensive timber harvesting in your forests up there in Wisconsin and not have consequence for the wildlife. So, yes, there is a balance to be struck, but it can't be a political balance, and it can't be a balance that pretends that we can do everything simultaneously. It has to be a balance that acknowledges what's most important to us. Americans, this is not a partisan issue. Americans almost universally support the idea of maintaining in a sustainable way our natural systems and natural lands. And once we grasp the idea that national parks, those islands as you called them, can't be sustained by themselves, I think that priority will become clear. Everybody agrees.
Let's bring in Sophie to the conversation. Sophie in Madison, hi.
Hi. I just had a question because I know that you all were talking about kind of expediting trees or the movement of trees to kind of combat the impact that they might see from climate change. And I was wondering what kind of impact actually that might have on the environments that you introduce those trees into. I didn't know if sort of expediting that process and interfering more could potentially have a negative impact on the environments, the atmospheres that you would introduce those species to.
Yeah, so Sophie, wondering about ecosystems as they transform.
The idea of adaptive management in taking climate change into account by moving species into new ecosystems is still extremely controversial among conservation biologists, among people who are kind of wondering what can we do about climate change for the future. For now, in Wisconsin, for instance, there are just programs to help people keep the mix of species they've got, but it still acknowledges that some of those species are going to be disappearing, like balsam fir. You're right to suspect that you could create a lot of disruption by just saying, well, it's getting hotter, so we're going to move some of these species that we've got a couple of hundred miles north. It's going to take a lot of planning, a lot of research, really good research, and a lot of thinking that we're not currently doing to figure out whether that's a feasible idea or not. It's easy to say casually, but it may not work well.
Let's bring in Nate in Eau Claire now. Nate, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My experience is having some forest land here in Wisconsin that's under the Managed Forest Law, which is a state program run by state, you know, foresters. I initially was concerned because it requires cutting, but clear cutting in large areas has produced a huge boon in wildlife. More diversity of wildlife, more deer, more turkeys, more grouse, more of everything I can see. So initially I was reticent to have to cut down big chunks of my forest, but now that I've watched it over, you know, a decade or more, it's like the best thing for people who like the outdoors and people who like wildlife. So I think the knee-jerk reaction is people's, man, I can't stand to see those trees get cut down, and I couldn't, but I had to. Right? It was law. But once they did it, I was like, that's the best thing I ever did to see wildlife on my property. So
sometimes
people are concerned about losing the trees. Actually, it increases the biodiversity.
Nate bringing in biodiversity there, he sees the results of that logging. Stephen?
Yes. Sometimes when a storm comes through or a timber harvest comes through and releases new life in a forest, that's a wonderful thing, just so it's thoughtfully managed. You're absolutely right that some species do very, very well after a clear cut, and yet that is not a universal kind of principle at all. You can imagine what happens if we cut more forests than we should in just to increase the amount of wild turkeys. There has to be a kind of a mix that does not prioritize timber harvesting. Instead, it prioritizes the question, if we have a timber harvest, what's the likely result? So I'm glad that you're seeing those results on your land. That's not unusual, and you're right to think that it's a good thing. As long as the natural systems come first, there are things that we can do, like timber harvest on the land.
Stephen, in the last minute and a half or so, where do we go from here? What should we be thinking about, policies we should be forming, and how to protect public lands in the end?
So there are two opposing forces currently in the American conversation. One has to do with science and management and climate change and protecting those public lands, and the other one has to do with short-term profit. These are lands that have been protected to some degree. The national parks are the primary example because of fights that our great-grandparents had, fights that Teddy Roosevelt undertook. We're in the same kind of fight now, and the sooner we realize it, the better, that these public lands are our heritage, one that we want to protect and pass along. We don't want to bust it all up and sell it off. we want to connect those lands and protect them. That's the conversation that has to take place, and that's the fight we're going to have.
Would the public still have some regulatory authority over public lands if we do sell some off? Or what is, on the individual level, a person who lives near a forest, what can they do?
Breaking them up and selling them off is the final act. You'll never collect them back together. Yeah, you can have some regulation on the margins, but it's going to mean that gas and oil and coal and copper are the priorities. You can't put those natural systems back in any conceivable way. What to do? Yes, write your congressperson. Yes, pay attention politically. But yes, also go online, put in protecting public lands, just three words, and in something like a millionth of a minute, you'll have 50 ideas of groups around you in Wisconsin that are already fighting these battles, sometimes very successfully.
Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Stephen Nash is a visiting senior research scholar, adjunct faculty member in the Journalism Department and Environmental Studies at University of Richmond. Up next, it's news. Then we take a look at the most recent news from the state capitol, including tax cut plans and a lame duck litigation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. We're getting up to speed on legislation and other developments at the state capitol. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Several things on the radar. Democrats and Republicans are working on plans to cut income taxes for the middle class, but they're at odds over how to pay for it exactly. There's a new lame duck legislative session lawsuit filed this week. And there's Foxconn. We learned environmental officials are reviewing air quality permits. We'll get to all of these things with your insights along the way at 800-642-1234. Which tax plan do you support and why? Do you see room for compromise? J.R. Ross is editor of WisPolitics.com. J.R., welcome back to the Ideas Network.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. So this week, Governor Tony Evers and Republican legislative leaders, they each unveiled their own plans for a middle-class tax cut. And perhaps as expected, the two sides are already at odds with each other over the plans. So let's start by having you briefly explain what each side wants to do here.
Well, they both want to target what they define as middle-class earners with a income tax cut. How they do it, however, is much different. And how they pay for it is much different. Let's start with the Republican plans. It was the one that's out first, all right? Republicans want to change your standard deduction that you have in your state taxes on a sliding scale. And then we are projected right now to have, we the state of Wisconsin, a ending balance in this fiscal year of about $691 million or so. They want to use that money to cover the cost of their income tax cut over the next 2-year budget, which starts July 1st. Tony Evers and some Democrats are out their plan, again, targeting how they define middle-income earners with a tax cut. It'd be a credit, a 10% credit. They also want to increase the earned income tax credit. That's a federal credit. You can claim a credit against your state taxes for that federal one. You want to boost that. But what they want to do is they want to cap a tax credit we have right now for manufacturers. It's called the Manufacturing Ag Tax Credit. They would not touch the part of it that impacts farmers. They would cap the one for manufacturers at the first $300,000 of income. That would generate money to help pay for their plan. And Tony Evers says he wants a tax cut that is paid for going forward, doesn't use one-time money, because the balance we have into this fiscal year is one-time money. It goes away. Republicans say they don't want to raise a tax to cut a tax. It makes no sense to them. So the point now is, will this be a game of chicken or will it be a game of compromise in the end about these two plans?
Well, Governor Evers said he cannot support a plan that has no plan for funding in the future. And meanwhile, here's what Assembly Speaker Robin Voss had to say.
I am glad that Governor Evers is trying to find ways to cut taxes, right? I think he has one flawed belief, is that is the only way that you can reduce taxes on some is to raise taxes on others. That is something we are never going to accept.
So, JR, are state lawmakers looking at the first really big challenge in this new era of divided government?
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Republicans have put their tax cut in a standalone bill. Governor Evers wants this debated inside the budget because, you know, the budget basically is the plan of all spending, tax credits, everything else for the next 2 years. Republicans are going to push this as a standalone bill. What I am watching is to see, do they go ahead and put this bill on Governor Evers' desk and try and challenge him to veto it, to see if they can get him on the, you know, on the record opposing a middle-income tax cut. Tony Evers, I suspect, and from talking to other people, it will make the argument that any tax cut should be dealt with inside the budget. So how will that work? And then, again, where is there room for compromise on this? Is there some way to kind of, you know, for example, I've heard the idea of with that cap on the manufacturers and the credit they can receive, raise the cap somewhat. Is there a way to do that? Republicans are saying no, that they're never going to cross that line. Well, if they won't cross that line and Tony Evers won't sign a plan that doesn't pay for itself, how do you get there? And that's a answer I don't have right now, and nobody else does that I talk to.
So what is next here? We've got a state budget proposal right around the corner. Is this battle over tax cuts just a preview of what's to come?
Oh, it is. It's a small preview of a much bigger battle, but a very important one because they're laying down markers about where they're at when it comes to things like this. And they have this shared goal, but they can't get on the same page about how to do it. And it's kind of symbolic of like what are a precursor of what we might see for the next 2 years is there are places they agree. I mean, they want to do things like address drinking water in Wisconsin, but they don't want to. Maybe they don't want to do it the same way. So how do you get there? And again, with this bill, where is there room for compromise? Can they find some kind of middle ground? And does Evers, you know, veto it and say, look, you know, go around the state and say, here's the tax cut I want you to have. We should not be giving manufacturers a generous tax cut. We should be taking that money and giving it to you. And Republicans make a successful argument of, look, that's not right to raise taxes on somebody to give them to you or other to other people. And, oh, by the way, those manufacturers provide jobs that have helped people in Wisconsin find work. So, no, it's going to be an interesting debate going forward.
We're checking in on news at the state capitol on a Thursday with J.R. Ross as our guide. He's editor of WisPolitics.com. You can join in the discussion, 800-642-1234. We saw this week unions filed a new lawsuit on Monday against the laws Republicans passed in December's lame duck session. What are you watching for as this litigation goes on? Did the lame duck session fundamentally alter government, or did you see it as a rebalancing of power? The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, JR, let's take a look at the latest lame duck lawsuit. It's now the third lawsuit we've seen targeting the lame duck session and what happened in that session. What's different about this latest lawsuit?
They all kind of center around the idea that Republicans didn't convene this thing properly. They did something that wasn't right. This one was filed by five unions and State Senator Janet Bewley, who's from up in the Ashland area, basically arguing that these lame duck laws violate the state constitution separation of powers clause. I'm not a lawyer, never pretend to be one. It'll be interesting to see how they make an argument in court that what they did, Republicans did, was inappropriate. Now, you can argue the politics of it, you know, all day long, but Republicans keep saying, look, they followed the law in convening extraordinary session. They passed the bill in a normal process, so they believe it's legal. These guys are arguing up front, the unions and Bewley, the ones that filed this lawsuit, that they're saying this runs counter the state constitution requirement to have a quorum of lawmakers present to do business, that that's because there's a provision in the law that give committees the ability to take legislative action, that I'm quoting here from the filing, giving power to effectively change a law to only a handful of legislators in the majority party. So that's their argument. I don't make no predictions about how it's going to go, but it is clear we will be in court on several fronts about this lawsuit, about these laws that were passed in December. What's more, it's kind of interesting, is that Attorney General Josh Call is declining to represent the governor or the Elections Commission because these laws changed his powers. Therefore, he says he has a conflict in defending others when it comes to these laws. That means we have private attorneys now hired for Governor Evers. We have private attorneys now hired for the Elections Commission. We have private attorneys hired for the legislature. So it's going to be an interesting battle. Now that the law legal bills aren't huge just yet, but if this goes on a long time, they could become quite expensive.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Attorney General Josh Call, who seemed to indicate that the Justice Department won't defend the state against this particular new suit.
In another case in which the extraordinary session was challenged, we made clear that the Wisconsin Department of Justice has a substantial interest in that case because the authority of the Department of Justice was impacted. We view that as a conflict with defending the laws.
So he sees conflict of interest. What do we know about who could represent the state instead?
So now, the lawyers I'm talking about were hired for other lawsuits. We have Republicans in the legislature have hired the former Solicitor General who served under Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel. He's going to be their attorney. I don't have that legal contract yet. The governor's office has hired a law firm of Lester Pines, who's a well-known Madison attorney. He's represented, been involved in all kinds of constitutional challenges. That contract, if I remember correctly, has a cap right now of $50,000, although it can go higher if needed. And then the Elections Commission in that previous lawsuit got Don Bach, who was a former deputy attorney general under Democrat Peg Lautenschlager. Mm. He and a couple of lawyers from his firm have got those guys. And you need a flow chart almost at some point to keep track of all these lawsuits and who's representing who. Now,
Definitely some lawyering up going on. So what reaction, if any, have we heard from Governor Evers and state Republicans to this latest case?
Republicans keep saying these suits are without merit. You know, they say they're on strong constitutional ground. Governor Evers has continued to say, look, you know, he doesn't like what they did, that these have taken away powers and wasn't right. So this latest one, the response from the governor's office is that they were studying or looking at legal counsel, determining how to proceed. But the quote from Melissa Baldoff, an Evers spokeswoman, is, you know, we've said repeatedly that the lame duck session was a hasty and cynical attempt by Republicans to override the will of the people, and that the governor expected legal challenges.
So do you expect to see even more lawsuits filed to come, or do you think this is the last?
That's a good question. So we've had this one, we had the previous one, we have the complaint filed by Jimmy Anderson, a representative from Fitchburg, alleging that Republicans violated the open meetings law because he was, you know, hit by a drunk driver, I can't remember how many years ago, is paralyzed from the chest down, is in a wheelchair. He had to leave the Capitol because he needs to get out of that chair for certain periods. He alleges that Republicans not given enough time to come back to the Capitol, didn't give him a warning, come back and vote, which is inappropriate. Well, Wisconsin now challenged the new restriction on early voting. They've already got a decision in that case. So those are the ones I know of right now. I can't tell you if anybody else is going to come down the pipe. But we've already got several fronts attacking these Republican bills from December.
Talking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. You can join in, 800-642-1234. How are you hoping the state proceeds with Foxconn? Should the DNR review air and water permits that have already been granted to Foxconn, or is this redundant? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll pick up the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're getting an update on state capitol news toward the end of a busy week on the morning show. I'm Kedar Cherkent. Governor Tony Evers said Tuesday that he had directed the DNR to review the air and water permits granted to Foxconn, and he said Foxconn is comfortable with these plans. Are you comfortable with reviewing its environmental permits, or is this needless since the work's been done? They're already granted. Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. J.R. Ross is our guide. He's editor of WisPolitics.com. J.R., before we talk DNR and these permits, let's talk about the news last week with Foxconn. Had a kind of a topsy-turvy week. We had report after report on Foxconn's plans, or perhaps not plans, to build this massive LCD screen manufacturing plant. Can you bring us up to speed on that past week and where we currently stand?
In short, we ended up Friday afternoon where we were Tuesday morning. What I mean by that was that Wednesday the story broke from Reuters quoting a top executive who raised questions about the feasibility of building screen, manufacturing screens in Wisconsin, citing the cost in the United States for labor versus other countries. Kind of said this might be more of a research and development facility or a packaging plant, things like that. Well, that set off a lot of alarm bells because Foxconn has had a history of falling short of its promises in other places where it's done business. And in Wisconsin, the original promise was to do up to 13,000 jobs, to invest up to $10 billion, and to build these massive LCD screens that, you know, bigger than king-size beds and that kind of thing. Well, they'd already, you know, a year ago, well, not quite a year ago, last summer, so they're going from, they call it Generation 10 to Generation 6.5 screens. They're still, you know, big screen TVs, but they're not as massive as the ones they first talked about. So we knew they were already scaling back, at least initially. So that story comes out. Then another one comes out from Nike out of Asia saying that they were suspending work at the plant, period, after negotiations with new governor Tony Evers because he wanted to renegotiate side deals. Well, immediately both Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation and Foxconn pushed back and said, no, that's not the case. Then on Friday, we get Foxconn saying they're moving ahead with the Generation 6.5 screens after talking to President Trump. So again, Friday afternoon, we were on Tuesday of these smaller screens.
Do we know what role President Trump played in all of this?
No, it's interesting. There's a new story out thinking about yesterday from Bloomberg, I believe, Bloomberg Business, talking about this plant was part of an effort by Foxconn to curry favor with the president because they wanted to avoid getting caught up in a trade war between China and the United States. The bottom line with all of this, though, is with Foxconn, we won't know what that plant's going to be and if it's going to be worth the investment, et cetera, for probably years. You can go back and look at the original promise that Foxconn made under that scenario. If it played out, the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, which is a nonpartisan kind of budget arm legislature, had projected it could be 25 years before the state broke even on the investment. So it's a remains to be seen what's going to happen. And the bottom line of Foxconn is it's not just about tax policy in Wisconsin, who the governor is. There are also global market forces that this company has to respond to. So if, like we've all seen stories about Apple and iPhones dropping orders because they're lowering expectations for the number of iPhones they're going to ship. Well, that impacts companies like Foxconn. That's an example of these global forces going on that could impact what that plant eventually looks like in Wisconsin.
Well, meanwhile, Governor Evers says he's also asking with the Department of Natural Resources to review air and water permits granted to Foxconn under the Walker administration. Here's a bit of what he had to say earlier this week.
We need to do a very thorough overview of what that proposal was and how it was responded to before, you know, we can make any decisions whether we're worried about it. But I think Foxconn believes that they've done what was asked for them.
So, JR, before you jump in here, I want to bring Tom in Burlington into the conversation because he wants to speak directly to this. Tom, go ahead.
I live in Burlington, and we're west of the Foxconn plant in Racine County. And the air comes from the Lake Michigan. It blows west sometimes. And there is no guarantee that whatever they're going to put in this air is going to be for anybody to breathe. And the water problem, what are they going to do with our wells? We have wells here, and if they contaminate the wells that we have, I mean, the whole thing is it's just not right. And what they've done over in their own country, they have no control over there.
So, JR, what is the significance here of reviewing these permits?
Well, it may not be much more than a review, that they look and say, okay, did everything properly, and away they go. One thing, to build off of what Tom was saying, is with the water issue, the original permit for this project was up to 7 million gallons a day from Lake Michigan. Well, if they're building smaller screens, how much do you need then? So we don't know that if those things, those changes they're making to the plant, change what the needs are in terms of those permits. I don't know how that plays off each other just yet.
Do we know what kind of investment, what kind of dollars the state of Wisconsin has put into preparing for Foxconn to build this massive plant and complex? You know, what are some of those costs that have already gone into this project?
It's an interesting question. There are costs such as they're right now expanding I-94 north-south in Racine County from 6 lanes to 8. It's 8 lanes in Kenosha County, 8 lanes in Milwaukee County, but not in Racine. there's a cost that's going to happen no matter what. There are costs like to expand roads around the Foxconn plant to try and improve the infrastructure. As far as tax credits, however, the company has to hit these marks to get these tax credits. Last year, they fell short of the minimum jobs required to get any tax credits. They had to hit, I think it was 260 jobs that qualify for these tax credits. They had to get those just to even qualify for anything. Their goal was 1,040. They fell short of the 260, so they got nothing in the first year. And that's the point Republicans keep trying to make, is that they don't get tax credits on jobs or the capital investment without spending the money here or hiring the people. But there are still fixed costs. And back to the point about that Fiscal Bureau memo, you know, we don't know if this is going to break even for years. We won't know the true cost for years. You have to separate out that question of, is the investment worth it versus what have they gotten so far? Because so far it's not much. Now, again, that doesn't account for the infrastructure costs or like rate payers are going to have to shoulder the burden of a new high voltage line out to that plant. Those costs are built in, but the tax credits haven't paid out yet because they haven't hired the people to qualify for them.
Do you think Governor Evers is looking for a way out of this deal, or is Wisconsin in it here regardless of what happens?
He suggested at various times that there's not really a way to break the contract. He keeps talking about transparency, openness, those kinds of things. That suggests that Evers wants to make sure this is done on the up and up, that there's a way to review it, that, you know, we have an actual accounting of what's going on. But as far as, like, breaking the contract, I don't think I've seen, unless I'm missing something, I don't think I've seen Tony Evers talk about doing something like that, because they've acknowledged this is a contract. It was signed by Scott Walker, you know. Barring some big problem, I don't know how to get out of it.
What will you be watching for on the Foxconn front moving forward?
What story do we get next about what's actually going to happen there? Do we see people hired? How does this plant develop? What do they actually put into the plant? I mean, they've talked about things like being an assembling line. They've talked about having a research development hub. They have these, like, innovation centers, they call them, in like Green Bay and Eau Claire, I think. They've got a national headquarters in Milwaukee. Who do they put in there? Who are they hiring? What jobs are they doing? We're still waiting for some of those reports about what's actually happening. But it could be some time before we see that. And then what's the market look like globally? Is there demand for these screens? Can they produce them here in Wisconsin at a competitive price and all that kind of good stuff? Those are things to watch. And then, two, what's the state's final investment? You know, I mean, again, they get the credits if they create the jobs needed. But in the end, Wisconsin is subsidizing their payroll if they hit those marks. I mean, how much do we pay out, and what's the return that Wisconsin gets on that investment?
Well, J.R., thanks for joining us. Thanks for taking time for us.
Anytime. Have a great day.
J.R. Ross is editor of WisPolitics.com. Just ahead, we look at why colleges and universities across the nation are dropping foreign language programs and foreign language courses, and we discuss the outlook going forward. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.